Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Hey folks, welcome to the Talky Bit. This is a little different, at least sonically different version of the Talky Bit podcast because it's a post-event recording of the topic that we were exploring on this particular week. And the reason I'm doing it this way is because we ended up having quite a sprawling conversation about this stuff when we were together in person, which is deeply engaging, very fascinating, quite life-giving from my perspective, and also doesn't necessarily lend itself to the tidiness of a podcast format very well. So welcome to the Talky Bit in this particular format on this particular day. One of the things that I'm finding very intriguing in the wider culture on this continent these days is the uptick in conversations about the importance and power of story. Now, I do understand that as humans, we tend to see what we're looking for, and unless otherwise provoked, we tend to filter out a lot of the rest. It's partly how we survive. We shortcut a lot of what we take in. If we didn't, we would be in a constant state of overwhelm. So for me, as a person who believes that stories really matter, I'm always looking for them, which means I'm inclined to notice them when they show up, whether that's in my own sphere of influence or it's in the world around me. When I take that into account, it might mean that I only think there's an uptick because I'm looking for one, right? Having said that, I think it's also fair to note that as part of the movement at this time toward much-needed correctives like reconciliation, decolonization, not to mention the growth in general cultural diversity, story-based cultures are getting a lot more airtime than they did when I was growing up, for sure, or at least where I was growing up. And I feel like we're hearing from a wider range of those cultures in influential ways. And to circle back, we see what we're looking for, so more and more of the influential voices surrounding us are starting to watch for these trends and are talking about the importance of stories. So I think there is an uptick, is my opinion, at least. As it turns out, our brains like stories too. And that's true whether we grew up in cultures that overtly carry meaning through stories or not. It's part of the explanation for why we dream. Our subconscious is working hard to try to turn all the bits of input from our day and from our wider life into one story. I'm not asking anyone to share about this, but if your sleeping brain is anything like mine, it can sometimes turn the events of the day into one pretty crazy story. Now, how does all of this relate to our continued exploration of how we form systems of belief, this series that we're in at the moment? Well, over the last couple of weeks, we've been digging down into layer one of those systems, a layer that we've been calling core assumptions or core beliefs. And we talked in previous episodes, you can look them up in our podcast archive, about the relationship between the word assumptions in that description and the word beliefs. Perhaps it seems a bit obvious when we say it out loud, but we don't arrive in the world with our core beliefs in place. They develop gradually, constructed from our experiences as our brains try to make sense of the world and our place in it. From very early on, we're thrashing our way through major existential questions like, who am I, where am I, what's my particular place in the world, and so on. And the most critical period for this development is childhood, when we're busy absorbing information about ourselves and we're creating meaning from everything around us. The messages we take in, the stories we compile at that stage of our development, are a deeply embedded aspect of who we are. And that's why we might use language like internalized for them. I internalized the message that I am, etc. Now again, some of this sounds obvious when articulated, but when it comes to exploring what we believe, it's worth reconsidering because it can be easy to forget just how deeply embedded, how thoroughly internalized our core beliefs can be from when we were a child. And as we've already considered, how these beliefs powerfully influence how we act in the world, not least of all, if we're not aware of what those beliefs are. All right? The more hidden they are, the more powerful they are in many ways. Since this layer of our belief systems, this core bottom layer, if you will, is often formed when we're children, it's not a surprise that some of the people who had the most influence in its formation were our parents or our caregivers. Some of the big building blocks in these layers are put in place by early childhood experiences. So, for example, if as a kid we received consistent warmth, encouragement, and acceptance, we're much more likely to have developed core beliefs like I am lovable, I'm capable, I'm safe, and so on. On the other hand, if we experienced criticism, neglect, emotional unavailability, or abuse, we're more likely to have internalized very different messages, such as I'm not wanted, I'm a burden, I'm not safe, and so on. One of the very influential voices around these ideas was the psychologist Carl Rogers, who identified what he called conditions of worth. And his idea is that as children, we learn that our value is conditional on us meeting certain expectations. That might be a bit simplistic, a bit mathematical when we say it in a sentence, and yet I think there's a lot going on here that we'll be able to resonate with when we think about it. So, for example, perhaps love and affection were only or predominantly expressed when we brought home a good report card, or we stayed quiet, or we took care of others. In the world of religion and religious beliefs, as we explored in our previous series on religious trauma, love and affection might have been tied to affirming particular beliefs or behaving in ways that were met with approval within a particular religious community or culture. Be a good boy, be a good girl, be a good person, as measured by those contexts, and you will experience me as affectionate and affirming and caregiving. Don't, I might withdraw those things, right? That's sort of an equation. What we internalize goes through our story-making filters, so to speak. So we might end up forming core beliefs like, I am only acceptable when I'm perfect, or I'm only worthy when I put others first. This is powerful stuff. And it's not easy to shake loose. I heard a fascinating interview this past week with Jay Pitter. Jay is the author of a book called Black Public Joy, No Permit or Permission Required. Pitter is what is called a placemaker, somebody who works at the crossroads of urban design and social justice. And her book, by her definition, is intended to reveal how culture, planning, and memory shape the way Black people and others can express joy in parks, streets, anywhere in a public space. But when you hear Jay talk about this stuff, you realize that this core belief of hers, that this should be possible, is hard won. And not least of all because she had to alter some childhood core beliefs to get there. I can't think of a more compact and telling way to illustrate some of what I'm trying to describe here than having all of us hear a bit of her story in her words. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you part of the transcript of that interview that I heard, and I heard it on the radio on CBC Radio 1, and so you can find this in its entirety on the CBC Ideas website and their archive, both as audio and in transcript form. It begins with a little bit of an intro to the whole interview. When she was a child, Jay Pitter experienced an incident with her mother that has always stayed with her. It has not only informed her life, but her work as well. She was 8 years old, shopping with her mother, and she remembers swaying to music that was playing at the mall. And at that moment, she was scolded by her mother, who felt that a Black person dancing in public was undignified and reinforced racist stereotypes. And that incident, she cites as the catalyst for her book, Black Public Joy, No Permit or Permission Required. She recently joined Nala Ayad, the host of Ideas, to talk about how that memory shaped her life and addresses the policing and self-policing that Black people can internalize. We begin with Nala's question. Do you remember what it sounded like when your mom rebuked you? Jay replies, it sounded like a lecture because she started telling me about a historical figure called Mr. Bojangles and how he danced in public with exaggerated hand gestures and movements. She used the term shuckin' and jivin'. And my mother was extremely careful about speaking the Queen's English. So when I heard her drop that G, I knew she was extremely serious. Wow, she meant business. She sure did. I remember her asking me if somebody was paying me to dance. That's quite a pointed question. Yes, she said that it made absolutely no sense for someone who was a black girl and poor growing up in public housing to be dancing in public unless someone was paying you a large amount of money. And how did you react as an 8-year-old? I remember it being my first encounter with shame, and it was secondhand shame. It wasn't mine, but I could feel it with a force. And you stopped dancing. I sure did. What stereotype do you think your mother was trying to stop you from falling into? There is a stereotype that black people are not intellectual or reserved or appropriate in public space. In the book Black Public Joy, you actually share with us your mother's list of prohibitions governing acceptable behavior for black people, especially girls and women in public, and they all start with the word never. And at this point in the interview, Jay just lists this list of prohibitions as follows. Never sit on the floor at the mall or on a subway station. Never idly hang out in public. Never tell private family business. Never respond to male attention. Never enter other people's personal space. Never appear timid or unsure of yourself. Never behave ghetto or uncouth in public. Was that list communicated to you as a list, or did you learn as you went along? I learned as I went along. When we were in public, she would point out black women and girls doing particular things, using them as examples. So if we saw a full-figured black woman, she would say, never wear bright colored jeans, especially if you were full-figured. Or she would see someone with bright red lipstick, and she would say, never wear bright red lipstick if you want to be taken seriously. So she would use other women and girls, particularly those in our neighborhood who are low-income, like us, as examples, as real-time cautionary tales. At what point do you think you started to resist this, to actively resist these instructions? Well, this is going to be a super strange thing for a black woman to say, but it was when I discovered Bruce Springsteen. So I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, and I love the way he always wore ripped jeans. And so I got new jeans, and I ripped all of them. And I would hang out at the Warden subway station with a bunch of friends, punk rockers, folks who were really into hardcore rock, hip-hop. And we sat on the subway platform floor, which also mortified my mother. So we had several standoffs about it. And then she told me that if I continued to do that, she wouldn't greet me in public anymore. I was the favorite child, and I hugged and kissed my mother in public well beyond the age that children want to associate with their mothers. My mother was beautiful, and I was very proud of her, but I mean, every 15-year-old girl wants to push against their mother, right? So I think it was a combination of being 15 years old, but also beginning to see beautiful expressions of black public joy emerging in my neighborhood. All right. I could keep going, but I'm going to leave the interview there because I found both the person and the interview very interesting, but I would happily lay out the whole thing, but I'm going to leave it for you to look it up for yourself if you wish to. It might be a rather interesting exercise to take some time to reflect on what the list of acceptable behaviors were that you or I internalized and what sort of experiences caused us to start reconsidering them for ourselves. Is there any intersection there about, for example, those conditions of acceptance, about affection in this case, in Jay Petter's story, affection being withdrawn, or at least the expression of affection being withdrawn in public if they didn't comply. One of the features I appreciate about Jay as a storyteller, and I find her to be a very engaging one, is the compactness with which she takes us through that process in her story about her mom. When she starts pushing back as a 15-year-old, mom threatens to withdraw her affection, and Jay feels the cost of that. She feels the ouch of that because she loves and is proud of her mom. And I don't know about you, but I feel like I can taste the harshness of that when she tells her story. I mention that because in a variety of ways, this has come up in our conversations here at the table. When we start to seriously explore what we believe, when we start to dig down into the layer that we've been calling core beliefs, the layer that was formed predominantly when we were young, and we find that we don't agree with everything we find there, messing with those beliefs can come at quite a cost. Let's come back to some of Carl Rogers' ideas about all this for a moment. Jay Petter has distilled these childhood inputs into a pretty tidy list. Quite explicit, quite clear-cut, and she illustrates it with these very memorable, kind of teachable moments with her mother. But the messages to a child don't need to be explicit for core beliefs to be formed by that child. This is one of the reasons why it can take some pretty deliberate self-examination to get at them. So, for example, a parent struggling with depression might be emotionally distant, which a child might interpret as I'm not important or I am unlovable, rather than understanding that the parent is unwell. A teacher's frustrated sigh when you ask a question might solidify a belief like I'm stupid. Having your inquiry about a religious belief shut down in a Sunday school classroom at a dinner table could settle into a belief like only bad people question what they were taught, or if I question what I'm taught, I am being a bad person, and so on. One of the things we need to remember in this consideration is that we're doing a lot of this belief formation work as children, when our larger task is trying to make sense of a sometimes rather confusing and overwhelming reality, and we need a story that makes sense to us, so we make one that explains what we're experiencing. It's important work. We do it to survive, among other things. But the context is part of the process, and as we grow and mature, our context changes. Our need for an explainer story doesn't change, but the information we have to work with, the tools we have available, the permission we can learn to grant ourselves in that story making and so on, all potentially change. One way to see how that works is to consider what other contexts we encounter as we grow up. So Jay talks about how exposure to other cultural inputs, in this case a musician and their music, as well as other music-related subcultures, was part of this process for her, like it could be for any of us. So can things like peer relationships during the school years, experiences like bullying, exclusion, or social rejection can pretty easily create beliefs like, I am different, I don't belong, there's something fundamentally wrong with me. And this is certainly an important part of my own story and something I fully expect to be unraveling until I die. Bullying, being picked last for a team, being laughed at during a presentation, all part of my own story and all things that still, in different ways now than before, but still impact me. By which I don't mean anything melodramatic, by the way. In my lived experience, the exploring never stops. And from a lifetime of conversations with other people, I suspect this is not at all unique to me. All right. So we haven't considered the impact of either small or big T trauma or of wider cultural or societal influences, both rather significant categories. And because it will be a while before we come back to this series, I want to leave us with something to explore on our own if we choose to do so. So let me suggest this. If you wish to or choose to spend some time on deliberately examining your own core beliefs, one way to do that is to start with the ones that feel more general, perhaps less consequential. What are some beliefs, for example, that you have recognized as possibly being true for your parents that are not true for you, that have been easy to let go of? Perhaps the context has changed, so your uncle's advice to not wear your seatbelt so you don't get trapped in a rollover is no longer your go-to standard for whether you wear a seatbelt or not, or whether you believe people should. If you want to do something that might be right on the line between amusing and terrifying, just do a search for parenting advice from the 1950s. Maybe this will be more amusing if you're not a parent and less amusing if you are, I'm not sure. I mean, less than 70 years ago, there were what we might call legitimate or real, not fake, ads explaining how cigarette smoking was good for your digestion. For example, my point is, start with the easy stuff, kind of like stretching before you go for a run. With some practice, we can get a bit better at working our way through the layers. And this might sound like a counterintuitive suggestion, and to be clear, that's all this is. It's a suggestion. But you might want to save the religious beliefs for later in the process. Not because they're necessarily more weighty, they might be, but not because of that, but because when we start to examine them more closely, many of them turn out to be pretty conceptual and hard to get a grip on. So some practice beforehand, feeling like we have some skill, naming, discerning, naming, examining, critiquing our core beliefs, some practice with all those things beforehand can be helpful. All right, I'm going to leave it there for now. It'll be a while before we come back to this because, well, summer. But if you ever find yourself feeling twitchy about a belief that feels like it's not working for you anymore, just know that it's okay to go exploring. And be assured that if you do it at the table, you won't need to be doing it alone. Peace.